Good evening. It's Sunday, January 31st, 2021. Coming up, as Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi criticizes protesters, farmers continue in their demands for justice.
The land holdings of these farmers are going to be taken away from them and will be given to big corporations. So they are going to be exploited because they'll forcibly have to give up their farms.
Prison rights advocates are turning up the pressure on Governor Newsom to take action as COVID deaths rise to nearly 200 in California prisons.
We witnessed this great public outcry as Trump rushed these federal executions of incredibly highly debatable cases. And our message to Newsom is, we hold you equally accountable.
And with just 12 days in office, President Biden has already taken more executive actions than his two predecessors.
Ideally, he wouldn't have to make so many executive orders. However, the broken level that the government was in when he received it, I think really called for a baseline of executive orders.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. Today, 10 Republican senators announced plans to counter President Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package with a plan that would reportedly cost around $600 billion. In a letter to Biden, the Republican senators, including Maine Senator Susan Collins and Utah's Senator Mitt Romney, said they devised a plan in the spirit of the bipartisanship and unity that the president has called for, and that they plan to release the entire proposal on Monday. With this GOP proposal reportedly adding up to nearly $1 trillion less than the Democratic plan, it's likely that it will receive opposition from the Democrats in Congress. However, the Biden administration said today that there may be room to compromise on some parts of Biden's proposed plan. In the 12 days that President Joe Biden has been in office, he's enacted 25 executive orders, 10 presidential memos, and 4 proclamations. This is reportedly almost as many as the combined number of executive actions taken by President Barack Obama and President Donald Trump during their respective terms. Cynthia Ganot is a race, class, and gender inequity-focused sociologist. Ganot speculated on why President Biden has signed so many executive orders so quickly.
The broken level that the government, the federal government, was in when he received it, I think really called for a baseline of, here is a whole palette of executive orders that will attempt to right the balance on a number of these issues, try to get things back on track, try to get the focus back on environmental protection, racial equity, and all the other issues that he's focused on. So I think ideally, I can only imagine if you ask President Biden, he'd ideally hope he wouldn't have to issue so many executive orders. But I think under the circumstances to fix and have a new starting point that he had to.
Ganot says she's hopeful about Biden's leadership.
One of the things about Joe Biden as an older white man, he says about himself, he actually said this line in a press conference lately. He said, I may not be much, but I sure know how to pick them. And he was being very self-effacing, of course, about, he was talking about his cabinet picks at the time. He truly has shown an incredible ability to surround himself with the top experts in any field. So number one, we've gone back to expertise, deep expertise in each area, and his honoring that, and we've gone to his building a set of folks who have differing backgrounds and perspectives from his to the table. And I think that is absolutely crucial, and that Kamala Harris is just an incredibly strong role model and voice for women of all different backgrounds.
For Biden's progressive critics who say he's doing too little, too slow, Ganot says change has to begin somewhere, and perhaps there's a role for all to play.
You know, one of the mistakes people made with Barack Obama was going, we got him in the White House, and then not pushing grassroots for the kinds of changes that we needed to the healthcare system and all the kinds of things that he was trying to do that he did do against unbelievable opposition. We need to be able to partner with, link arms with, yes, be critical, talk about what needs to happen next, but we're reconstructing our society in so many ways. So let's construct it in the way that we want it to be, and let's do it together.
That's sociologist Cynthia Ganot. Tens of thousands of farmers have been protesting in Delhi for the last several months, demanding the repeal of agricultural laws that they say will benefit corporations while serving as a detriment to India's farmers. A caravan of tractors journeyed over 400 kilometers from Punjab to the nation's capital to voice their opposition. Today, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi criticized protesters for storming Delhi's Red Fort on the country's Republic Day, saying, quote, "The country was saddened by the insult to the tricolor on the 26th of January in Delhi," and adding that the government is committed to modernizing agriculture. But protesters, farmers, and many people across India say that while Modi's plan may be profitable for corporations, it does not account for the well-being and livelihood of farmers across the country. Arinder Kaur is originally from Punjab, India, where her father still owns farmland.
It has been going on for decades. The farmers have always been exploited. But last year, the Prime Minister of India enacted these three laws. And it's kind of an autocratic move on his side because he didn't really consult the farmers. And by these new laws, the land holdings of these farmers are going to be taken away from them and will be given to big corporations. So they are going to be exploited because they'll forcibly, they'll have to give up their farms.
Just to clarify, these are farms that the farmers themselves own, and now the government is going to be redirecting the ownership of this land to the corporations. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is correct. The current farmers who own these small pieces of land, they will become like contract workers on their own land. So they will lose ownership, which will go to the big corporations, and then they will be kind of re-employed on their own land, not as owners, but as contract workers.
So what are farmers saying, and what is everybody else saying about this?
They want to abolish these laws. The Supreme Court has put a stay on these laws, but the Prime Minister is just very adamant. He doesn't want to listen to the farmers' demands, and he wants to go forward with these laws. So it's a status quo right now.
And this is a speculative question, but what do you think the ripple effect in the overall country of India would be?
I would say there's going to be more poverty.
And Kaur says that farmers can't endure the threat of being driven into further poverty, as nearly 300,000 Indian farmers have reportedly died by suicide in the last 2.5 decades.
The crops they are selling, they are not getting full value for those crops. As a result, they are not able to pay off whatever the expenses are for the agriculture, the land tilling, or the equipment, tractors. They don't have enough money to purchase all these farm equipments. So they are indebted. On top of that, you know, the interest is charged on that. And as a result, they are never able to get out of it. And I've heard many young farmers just committed suicide because they are not able to pay back these debts.
If agricultural modernization is Modi's priority, Kaur says the government could institute federal programs to support the farmers rather than doing what she says is amounting to a land grab.
These farmers are poor, so they don't have any cold storage. Maybe government can provide some cold storage where they can store their crop. They are using so much pesticides, and which is causing a lot of cancer in Punjab, in India. In fact, you know, I heard there's a train which goes to this hospital. It's called the cancer train. All the people who are sitting in there, they have cancer and they're going for treatment. So obviously they need to remove those pesticides, those harmful pesticides, and encourage organic farming.
And that would take, again, the government to be on the side of the farmers as opposed to...
Exactly, exactly.
What kind of movements are forming across the country, and what could the international community be doing to support the farmers?
Well, it depends on which side are you on. You know, if you are on the side of the farmers, then of course we have to support them so they are given the proper rights. I know of Khalsa Aid, which is run by the Sikh gentleman from the UK. He is providing a lot of aid, like free food. And also they provided tents for places to sleep for all these farmers and medical care.
That's Arinder Kaur speaking about the farmers' protest in Delhi, India. Today, protesters led a car caravan in Oakland before rallying to send Governor Newsom a message.
Their people are dying due to medical negligence, and people are dying due to inhumane infrastructure, and people are dying due to the ongoing humanitarian crisis that is mass incarceration. Then this is nothing short of a state execution. And we hold you accountable, Newsom. We don't buy your 2019 moratorium on the death penalty.
But Governor Newsom has taken great measures to protect the general public in California with several shelter-in-place orders, some that have caused him to clash with the business community and have even made him the subject of threats. Advocates for the incarcerated population say Newsom has fallen short in protecting those in California prisons. Courtney Morris is an organizer with No Justice Under Capitalism.
We are currently at 192 deaths that have occurred within the California state prison system. At this point, nearly half of the entire incarcerated population has had COVID. The average age of those who have died of COVID is 63 years old. So these are our grandfathers, these are our fathers, our uncles. Almost 80% of those who died had a disability, and over 70% were people of color. 49 of them were due for release or were eligible for parole in 2021. And so that is a huge, significant number of folks. But regardless, none of them had a death sentence, but they were given a death sentence because you are twice as likely to die in prison from COVID than in the general population.
And what message do protesters want to send to Governor Newsom? Again, Courtney Morris.
We witnessed this great public outcry as Trump rushed these federal executions of incredibly highly debatable cases. And our message to Newsom is, we hold you equally accountable. When people are dying, when our community is dying behind prison lines due to criminal medical negligence at the hands of the state, that is a state execution by COVID-19. It was spread due to botched transfers at a time when the entire state was shut down. A report from the Office of the Inspector General in October of last year stated that 23 of 35 prisons were routinely not following guidelines, including wearing masks. They've done nothing to social distance incarcerated people, and they have been found guilty of indifference in court filings. They have been found guilty of being in violation of the Eighth Amendment, no cruel and unusual punishment.
Minister King X is the director of California Prison Focus. He was incarcerated in California State Prison in the early 2000s. He says that some of the same elders that empower younger incarcerated people to find their way get lost in the system and remain behind bars far too long, which he says is particularly dangerous in a pandemic.
When you go to the superior court level and they're getting railroaded, and then when you come inside the prison system, you only have a year to appeal your case. Now you're lost in the system. You don't have a lawyer. You don't have no type of real support. And these men and women get lost in the system. They grow old, and it's like out of sight, out of mind. That's the old saying. So they forget about them, and people tend to leave them for dead. Now we have a pandemic, and again, you know, COVID-19 is just another tool of torture for the slave owners.
When discussing prison releases for nonviolent offenders, Minister King X says there simply isn't time for fear-mongering.
We believe that certain things are heinous, so we don't participate in certain things. So when you have isolated incidents, but again, the fear-mongers, they take it and they attach it one incident, one isolated incident, and say, okay, here's a three-strike situation, right? Next thing you know, somebody getting life, 75 to life for a stolen piece of pizza or a bike. That's unjust. And the public should know that. So I think what happens is when we have in our groups, for example, a lot of times we have study groups. A lot of times when we have in our meetings, we're educating the public. So I encourage people to get involved, you know, to get involved with our pop-ups, to read the newspapers, the California Prison Focus newspaper, the San Francisco Bay View newspaper, read the newspaper and hear from the incarcerated class themselves and see how you have people that's returning citizens that's doing really good And it could be the type of examples we're coming home to get involved, and we're coming home to say that no one is beyond redemption.
That's Courtney Morris of No Justice Under Capitalism and Minister King X, the director of California Prison Focus. You're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. Haitians are protesting in cities across the nation to demand that President Jovenel Moïse leave power on February 7th, making way for a transitional government. Today, Haitian trade unions called for a general strike on February 1st and 2nd. KPFA's Ann Garrison reports.
Protesters accuse Haitian President Jovenel Moïse of failing to uphold the rule of law or protect them from widespread gang violence, including gang rapes, massacres, and kidnappings for ransom. Black Agenda Radio spoke to Daoud André, an organizer with the Brooklyn, New York City-based Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti, who said that President Jovenel Moïse has been ruling by decree without a legally constituted national legislature.
The reality is for more than a year now, we can say there is no parliament in the country. Jovenel Moïse has been ruling by decree, and this is supported by the United States and the core group that, of course, he's doing their bidding. The people in the streets are saying that they are not going to elections or in constitutional referendum with Jovenel Moïse. So the call is for his ouster by whatever means necessary.
André said that the United States stands behind Jovenel Moïse and Haitians should expect nothing new from President Joe Biden.
The United States has already said, and of course they're the ones calling the shots, that this is the election year and they expect him to relinquish power 2022, February 7, 2022. So the real fight that's going on is between what the United States wants to impose on the Haitian people and what the Haitian people themselves they are fighting for. Now, with this election that happened in the United States, there are some Haitians who are misguided, of course, who believe that Joe Biden has some kind of interest in the well-being, in rule of law in Haiti. We call them Haitians with a very short memory, because for them, it's like Jovenel Moïse had a particular kind of relationship with Donald Trump. These Haitians forget that the election of Martelly, who handpicked Jovenel Moïse, Martelly was put in power by the Democrats. This is the Clintons, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden as president. Jovenel Moïse was elected with Joe Biden as vice president, Barack Obama as president. And so we're saying to these Haitians, you know, you might have forgotten, but Joe Biden was in power when Jovenel Moïse was imposed illegally, illegitimately, on the Haitian people. So for us, the battle is in the streets, and the people should be clear that there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that we are to expect from the incoming Biden administration regarding the reality in Haiti.
In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
Public school closures to contain the spread of COVID-19 is disrupting the education of millions of students. Among those hardest hit by public school closures are disadvantaged children and youth. KPFA's Rodolin Ginto reports.
About a year ago, most public schools in California were ordered to shut down to help slow the spread of COVID-19. The public school closures were a coordinated response by school board members and county officials. By the summer, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that schools were to remain closed until counties have stabilized COVID-19 infections and hospitalizations. This meant 6 million California students were not allowed to attend school for in-person instructions. Instead, all education for most of the students were held online. Dr. Vinay Prasad, health policy professor at the University of California, San Francisco, says this is bad policy. He says school board members and policymakers should consider the following factors when deciding if schools should shut down.
Schools provide a net service even at times of COVID transmission. A school board, it's fair for a school board to think of their staff and their teachers. Of course, they should do that. They should also think of the kids, and they should also think of the community. And I think they have to balance those three interests. I worry at times that they focus disproportionately on misperceptions about how it'll affect the teachers and staff, and less so about the kids. After all, kids don't get to have a voice in a lot of these meetings. They're not there speaking out on their own behalf. And sometimes I worry that the community also gets pushed to the side as well.
Proponents of school closures say protecting public safety was one of the drivers for this decision. But Prasad says, in addition to students missing out on the vital services schools provide, mothers and low-income communities are disproportionately impacted by school closures.
Finally, the risks to mothers. Women are dropping out of the workforce in record numbers. There are risks to society by keeping schools closed. These sort of long-term risks of pulling out affluent kids and moving them into sort of a two-tiered system. The impact of this on long-term earnings and upward mobility, those have real repercussions for all of us. A society that is deeply unequal is a volatile society. And so I think it's very important to prioritize schools.
Prasad says several studies have been published in other countries that found no increase in COVID-19 cases due to schools being open. He explains why he thinks we aren't reopening schools.
One of the reasons why I think we are not opening schools is availability. Availability means what you see is what pulls on your heartstrings. And every day I look at the New York Times and I see that counter of people who have COVID and who are dying of COVID. And my heart breaks. I want that number to be lower. And it has an availability on me. But the New York Times doesn't have a counter on there that says all the kids who didn't eat this week, all the kids who are going hungry, all the kids who are getting beaten, all the kids who are getting abused, all the kids who are praying that somebody will come and rescue them, all the kids who are losing grade levels, all the kids who will never go to college, all the kids who will someday become teen pregnant, all the kids who will join gangs and engage in gang violence, all the kids who will get shot. There's no counter for that. There's no counter for missed grades. There's no counter for missed opportunity. There's no counter for lost youth. And it does not have the same emotional pull.
For KPFA and Pacifica Radio, this is Rodolyn Ginto.
Race has always been a big issue in U.S. politics, but what connection does it have to democracy? To find out, KPFA's Saturday news anchor David Rosenberg spoke with Howard University political science professor Clarence Lucan.
There has consistently been a recognition that African Americans have been very critical in pushing for democracy in the U.S. and that African Americans, the people of color, because of history of slavery, colonialization, marginalization, Jim Crow, have out of necessity fought for not just addressing issues of racial discrimination, but essentially pushing back against these authoritarian structures that people have been forced to live under. So when we look at authoritarianism in the Trump era and in this current period, we have historic amnesia because there have been long periods where these other communities have not had the same rights, same opportunities, same access to justice as other communities. And so the record is there. I think what has been perhaps missing has been for particularly, I think, a younger generation of racial justice activists to marry the language of racial justice with the language of democracy and to not see those as separate struggles, but that in fact one builds upon the other.
You do hear race talked about in terms of economic justice, but are you saying that's really not enough, that democracy has to be included in that discussion?
Absolutely. So it's missing, for example, in the push with the incoming president, with now President Biden, has been a democracy agenda. So Biden has outlined four priorities: the pandemic, the employment crisis, the racial justice concern, and climate change. But what needs to be added to that, I would argue, ended up in a situation where all of the issues are urgent, have to do with the democracy deficit. And that if we were truly a democratically structured system, then we would be able to put in elected office and put in place public policy that would have addressed a lot of those concerns. And so until we do that, then we consistently are in a position where someone like a Trump, or more generally like the entire Republican Party at this point, will be able to not only win in an undemocratic manner, but govern in an undemocratic manner.
That's Howard University political science professor Clarence Lussain speaking with KPFA's David Rosenberg. Tom Vilsack's nomination as the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture outraged many progressive activists and environmental leaders. Vilsack is a former governor of Iowa and served as Secretary of Agriculture for 8 years in the Obama administration. KPFA's Rodolin Ginto reports.
Amanda Starbuck, senior food researcher and policy analyst at Food and Water Watch, is among the many activists concerned about Vilsack's selection.
The administration's made a big point of building back better and trying to get new blood and new energy into cabinet positions. So to choose someone who's already had a run of this before didn't really seem to fit with that mentality. Not to mention, he doesn't have the best track record for working on behalf of the farming community.
Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina and many organizations have endorsed Representative Marsha Fudge of Ohio to be the next Secretary of Agriculture.
She has worked really hard to strengthen access to nutritional benefits, so things like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, what we formerly called food stamps, to make sure that everybody has equal participation in the food system and access to food. She's also been a really good champion for fighting back against attempts from the industry to increase line speeds at our slaughterhouses. She's been endorsing bills on that behalf and really fighting back against that. And not to mention, she's also a woman of color, and she has also worked to help end, you know, root out the systemic racism that we've seen within the USDA. And she just would have really, I think, embodied that move towards USDA needs to go.
The United States Department of Agriculture is expected to play a major role in President Biden's response to climate change. The administration has set a goal of achieving a net zero carbon economy by 2050. But activists like Starbuck are concerned that Vilsack will prioritize policies that favor corporate agribusiness over the interests of farmers and rural Americans.
I'm afraid he's going to move forward business as usual. You know, we didn't see a lot of change. We didn't see him, you know, tackling corporate consolidation under his tenure. We also didn't see any meaningful move towards mitigating climate change, both in terms of the impacts and contributions from agriculture to climate change, but also how to help farmers, you know, who are going to be facing more floods, more droughts, more unpredictable weather in the future. You know, unfortunately, the only real plan we have seen from Vilsack and the Biden administration when it comes to climate change is this idea of using a carbon bank. But the idea of basically selling emissions credits to farmers for sequestering carbon in their soil. The companies that are pushing forward this idea of a carbon bank are big corporations that have been a part of the problem since the beginning.
Starbuck says the USDA needs to incentivize farmers to practice more sustainable agriculture. She says more public funding needs to go into existing farm bill programs that work. At the same time, she says the department must work to close loopholes that allow industrial factory farms to capture funding meant to help sustainable agriculture. For KPFA and Pacifica Radio, this is Rodolin Ginto.
And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, cloudy tonight with lows in the upper 40s, cloudy tomorrow with a chance of showers and highs in the low 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, cloudy tonight with lows in the high 40s, partly cloudy tomorrow with highs in the low 70s. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Rodolin Ginto, Ann Garrison, and David Rosenberg for helping to prepare tonight's news, and to Radha Keel, who's at the controls. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.